Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Everybody else does.
The Smiths, How Soon Is Now, originally released on the B-side to single William, It Was Really Nothing, released in 1984 on Rough Trade Records, and it was belated released as a single in the UK on the 28th of January 1985 when it reached 24 in the UK singles charts. That's a mouthful, isn't it?
So, one of their most amazing songs was originally released by Rough Trade as a B-side because they didn't think it was representative enough of the band's sound at the time.
Ooh. All I can talk about here is tremolo guitar. Because, to me, that is one of the greatest records that's ever been recorded.
Really? This is,
yeah, with tremolo guitar. Magnificent. Every time I hear it, it gets me wanting to get me Fender amps out and Voxes and stuff and actually go, dug-a-gug-a-gug-a. It's fantastic, you know? And actually, I'm not exactly sure whether it was done with a pedal or an effects unit in the studio or actually the amps, because it's like, it's across the stereo image, you know?
Yeah.
So it's got that dug-a, and also it's very much in time. Yeah. With the drums.
Well, so, I read about that, by the way. And they said they played the track back through four old twins, one on each side.
Ah.
This is secret information that you haven't read about because it took me ages to find this. And they had to keep all the amps vibrating in time to the track with each other. So they had to keep stopping and starting the track. So basically recorded it in 10-second bites.
There we are.
There you go.
Well,
woo!
How
20
good is
points
that?
To the Starlight.
That's fantastic. How soon is now?
And that's weird, you know, because you know, I hadn't realised until, because I've never listened to it through the headphones, just how it makes your whole body go, doesn't it? The vibrato at the beginning, that dugga dugga, and it pans as well. It goes from left to right. It's crazy. It makes you feel a little bit like strange.
Absolutely amazing. And, you know, the lyric, Morrissey, I mean, like him or not, a lot of people don't like him. I like him when he's great and I don't like him when he's not great, you know?
Yeah.
I've got this sort of love-hate relationship with Morrissey. But there's absolutely no doubt that that guitar is just magnificent. And he is one of my favourite UK guitar players, modern ones, you know. Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead, of course.
Yeah.
But he's just magnificent, you know.
What it said as well is that Johnny Marr tried to, he wanted to write a song just experimenting around one chord, and in this case it was the F sharp. And with the producer John Porter, they both were thinking, they started jamming and talking about early Elvis Presley records. And so they jammed That's All Right, and then that's how, because originally the song was called Swamp.
And it sounds swampy, it does sound
swampy.
Yeah, it
does, doesn't it? And apparently Morrissey came in the next day after they'd done this track, and he collated the lyrics from his book of words that he had, and he basically did them in two takes. He just wrote them overnight, took them from his book, and that was it. Job's a good one.
Yeah, you know, and you live on your own and you go home and you want to die. It's a classic, it's a classic Morrissey, you know, lyric. But the interesting thing about John Porter, the producer, is that he worked later on with an awful lot of blues artists.
Did he really?
Taj Mahal, B.B. King,
ah.
Loads of people that you just don't expect. But he started off because he was in a band originally with Brian Ferry. In Newcastle upon Tyne, and he went on to work.
You can
with
have 20
Roxy
points
Music.
For that. Ah, I had no idea. Yeah, get
he,
you.
Woo! He went on to work with Roxy Music, and and Jam Studios that was done in London. This is because the funny thing is that when I first started playing guitar, well, it was a bit later on actually when I was in Roadrunner and those sort of bands. I was with a manager called Jack Moss, who we're still friends with on Facebook, and he had a place called Jam Studios in Bolton.
Ah.
But we're talking, this is Jam Studios in London, where many great songs were recorded by New Order and many others down there.
It's funny as well, because they're talking about, because I wondered why they went to London, but they had one guy in the band at one point, just because you could get them into a local recording studio for a bit of time.
Yeah.
But that's what it happens, isn't it? You've got an amp, you can join the Rolling Stones. You could, you know, it's just like, you've got the gear, let's do it. But I must say, now that I've started playing bass and the kind of music that I'm really into, I can honestly say that's the first time I've heard that song and thought, I really love it.
Mm.
Isn't that weird how your tastes change over time?
Well, they do, but it's got so much atmosphere, that track as well. And what you don't really listen, because you mostly hear that tremolo guitar, which is a feature all the way through it, but you hear all those backwards guitars in the background. And, you know, Johnny Marr is spectacularly good, you know, guitar player. But he doesn't sort of do lead per se. But his parts are beautiful.
And he does guitar soundscapes.
And his guitar orchestration is really, really good. Rather like, you know, Johnny Greene from Radiohead and those guys. And you know, it's a beautiful thing. Beautiful.
Black Sabbath and Iron Man from their second studio album, Paranoid, released on the 18th of September in 1970 on Vertigo in the UK and Warner Brothers in the USA.
Forget Jimmy Page. Forget him. Forget him. Write him off. Completely.
Are you feeling okay?
Well, this. He is the king of the riff. The king, Tony Iommi, is the king of the riff. Magnificent. Every riff he did. And was it who said the fact that every riff he came up with was better than the last one?
Well, yeah, because they used to challenge him. They used to say, go on, you can do better than the last one. So that's what happened.
It was
the whole band, really. Basically, Ozzy was saying that. They used to challenge him to beat his last riff every time they got into the studio. Because Geezer Butler used to work on the lyrics and
that's
stuff.
That's right.
Yeah. So, and do you know what it was originally called? I Am Iron Bloke.
No.
Yeah, because apparently when Ozzy first heard it, he said it sounded like a big iron bloke walking around.
And it's from Birmingham.
Yeah. I am Iron Bloke.
Oh, God, that's very well, you know, and I'm being serious here. I mean, Jimmy Page, you know, master guitar player and all those things. And he played great riffs and great guitar orchestration. But, you know, what I like about Iommi is solos. You can sing them. Beautiful. And they're not just solos. And he'll go off on one, a little bit of a solo. And I loved towards the end of that, because obviously what they did two takes of the solo. It was one that wasn't really great, and one which really was great. The one that's really great is pan to the right side. The one that isn't really great is pan to the left, and they just keep bringing little bits in.
Really?
Yeah, listen to it, it's like a couple of bars here. And you listen back to it on headphones,
that's quite funny.
It's funny. And the other thing about it, it's very basically recorded. Roger Bain produced this.
Yeah.
And the bass, it's really toppy, and it's like, it's not really bass, it's pretty horrible sound, actually. And the drums are like quite wooden, and the vocals, but Iommi's guitar sounds fantastic. But the whole thing, it kind of shouldn't work, but when you listen to it all together, it sounds fantastic.
It's a bit odd, isn't it? It's like very, the bands of that time, I was just thinking about this as I was listening to them, they all kind of have these apocalyptic kind of, can't say the word, themes.
Yeah.
Don't they? Sort of like the end, they've seen the end of the universe, so they go back and people mock them, and so, you know, end up, everyone gets dead sort of thing. Just all doom and gloom. But it was recorded in London in 1970 at Regent Sound Studios and also Island Studios, only 4 months after they'd released their first album, Black Sabbath, because they wanted to get in there.
Well, it's rather surprising because when they recorded the album in a weekend, the first one, almost live, and nobody wanted to do it except for Roger Bain. He was the only producer that they worked with them that would do it like just virtually all live. And they did it in a weekend. And when they came back 2 weeks later, they realised they were in the charts.
That's right. I saw that on the documentary. That was like, what a beautiful gift that is to come back and go, crikey.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I mean, Paranoid itself, the whole record, I mean, it is considered as one of it's a monument to heavy metal music, isn't it, and heavy rock. It started it off, really. And but again, I think it was the darkness of the lyric. It was Iommi's brilliant guitar work and riffs, you know, and it still sounds incredibly heavy, and these guys are not tuning down. This is like a standard tuning in it, but it sounds heavy. It's just the epitome of heavy rock to me.
Pretending like I do. You said all there is to say.
Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Breakdown from their debut album, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Surprisingly enough.
Exactly. Released on the 9th of November in 1976 by Shelter Records.
Shelter Records, owned by Denny Cordell and keyboard player Leon Russell.
Yeah, get you.
Denny Cordell, of course, was the mentor to Tony Visconti. He was the one that brought him across to the UK. And he, of course, did, well, not of course, you might not know this, but the Whiter Shade of Pearl with Procol Harum. He was a master producer.
Isn't that crazy?
He was born in South America as well and then came over to England. So there you are, Denny Cordell. But the only thing I've got to say about this, because we're on guitar player, this is a guitar player edition, there's no doubt about it, right?
Okay.
And I'm going to say my namesake, Mike Campbell. Mike Campbell, he's brilliant. It's not just good, he's brilliant. His guitar sound is fantastic. Sensitive, appropriate, musical, absolutely tremendous. That lick, dee-dee, it's the way he plays it. Now, you know, if you go to you go and see cover bands and all. And I've not seen a lot of people do this. We've played this a few times, haven't we?
Yeah, when Tom Petty died, we did it.
Yeah, we saw the tribute to him.
It, yeah. It's a beautiful song.
And we did it. And to get that sensitivity of the guitar, because it's just on breakup as well, just lovely, you know. And Tom Petty's vocal, you know.
I love
great.
The harmonies as well. You just want to sing along with it.
They were a great band. And this first album they did, you know, was amazing. Because they were from the deep south, weren't they? You know, it was all...
Yeah, yeah. Gainesville, Florida.
Yeah, Leonard Skinhead sort of... that was, you know, who they were competing against down there, all that sort of southern stuff, you know, southern rock. So they went up to get to California. And I think they visited four record companies and eventually they got a deal within a week or something.
Yeah, it was something that I can't remember the detail of it now. It was a great documentary.
Yeah.
What I find quite heartwarming as well for Tom and his journey is that it didn't receive a lot of attention, his first album in the United States when they first released it. And I don't know, I can't remember the detail, but they went over to Britain, did a tour. And I remember that they were on Top of the Pops and it got to number 24 on the UK album charts. And Tom Petty was saying that the audience just jumped up and charged the stage and they were dancing with them. And he'd never seen anything like it before. And because of the success of Breakdown in the UK, it was re-released in the US and it became a top 40 hit in 1978. Good girls! Go on, Hummock!
Yeah,
eat the burglars!
Yeah, yeah.
Good girl! And anyway, so they had to go to the UK for the success to filter back, to be taken seriously and get some success in the USA. And actually, their second album, it was released in 1979, called Damn the Torpedoes.
Great name.
It's great, isn't it? You're right. It is a great name. And that was their commercial breakthrough. It sold over 2 million copies, and it couldn't have come at a better time because apparently Tom Petty had filed for bankruptcy just before it was released.
Yeah, which is incredible. Because, I mean, our first record had American Girl on, right? You know, I mean, that is super poppy. And the thing about Tom Petty at the time, 76 when it came out, so it's just before punk, right? And that American Girl thing fit in perfectly with punk. It was one of those, it was like a side track. Yeah. And that's why I think Tom Petty got on very well in the UK, because it really connected to punk. Because you listen to that, you know, that American Girl, and then you listen to, you know, the punks of this, certainly the post-punk stuff like Elvis Costello and all those things, more song-based, but more sort of upbeat and, you know.
Yeah.
It couldn't have come at a better time, really. And obviously, breaking in the UK is cool, but not like breaking in America. Americans bought hundreds of millions of records, didn't they,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, I get it.
Or tens of millions, anyway.
Well, what a great story, though. And I just loved the way that he just carried on. He kept doing it. And apparently, well, I mean, you can see it from his interviews. He's just really, he was really down to earth and a really blinking great chap.
Yeah. And I mean, the Wilburys, he did all the stuff he did. I've always loved him. I've always loved Tom Petty. I thought he was a great artist. And the band, I mean, forget about the band as well, because
true.
The band are fantastic.
You're part of the team, aren't you, really?
And it's not just Mike Campbell, it's the whole lot of them together, you know, working as a team. And that's what creates the sound. Fantastic.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they've tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. Working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be.
meant to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
You're listening to The Supertone Show with... Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was Working Class Hero by John Lennon and the Plastic Ono Band. I didn't hear very many Plastic Onos in that.
No.
Or a band, for that matter.
It was just him and his guitar, by the sounds of it. Released in 1970 on the Apple label, the first release after the breakup of Les Beatles.
Well, it just goes to prove that, firstly, two chords can make a magnificent song. That lyric is, you know, and the delivery thereof is something that is, you can't quantify the power of it. You know, and a very simple recording. That's it. No reverb, hardly. Basic guitar. Didn't sound all that great, the guitar. It was some old thing, probably. Don't know.
I was thinking as I was listening to it, because it said that he used the same folk blues acoustic guitar pattern that Bob Dylan used for his song Ballad, The Ballad of Hollis Brown. So,
of course.
And apparently he did about 100 takes of it, John Lennon, until he was happy with it. But apparently it's two different takes.
Spliced. Is that right?
Just what, at 1 minute 24, just before the verse, apparently that's where they cut. So it's a combination of two takes. So it wasn't even done in a one-er. Which, you know, in those days, actually, I think it's pretty good, because most people now drop in every other word, don't they? So
100 takes.
I know, but that's a bit excessive. I think Elvis used to do about 50, didn't he, really?
Yeah, especially with acoustic guitar and vocal, 100 takes, that's a lot. But, you know, I mean,
It depends where his confidence was as well, you know, what his vision for the song was, because to me that just sounds like he's doing a Bob Dylan thing. John Lent tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to be Bob Dylan. I know it's a beautiful song, but it's like, I suppose the venom comes in the lyrics. He doesn't actually express it in any emotion. It's very flat emotionally. So he just kind of sings it, and the cut is in the words, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, it's poetry to music, isn't it, that, really?
Yeah.
And it was recorded at his home studio, I think, as well.
It's crazy, isn't it? I mean, it's been covered by loads of people, like Green Day, Ozzy Osbourne, Tin Machine with David Bowie, Richie Havens and Marianne Faithfull.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't
loads
know
of
Tin
people.
Machine did this. Yeah. I'll have to listen to that.
So it's, I mean, it's, what do you say to that, really?
Well, you can't say anything except it's you know, it's of its time, but just as relevant now as it was then. What do you think?
Yeah. I think he just... I don't know, I just felt he was a bit too much like Bob. I wanted to hear something new, different from him, really, after the Beatles, that's all. But because I think he got there afterwards. I think he definitely went and improved and matured. But then, you know, what do you do when you've come out? I mean, he'd just fallen in love with Yoko. Obviously, he'd been with her a couple of years, and it was all new and all change. And I suppose you just got to keep putting stuff down and recording and writing until you find... where you're moving on to. It's part of the journey, isn't it, that one?
Chance his girlfriend came across a needle, and soon she did the same. At home there are 17-year-old boys, and their idea of fun is being in a gang called the Disciples, high on crack and toting a machine gun. Time.
stealing off a church and kill everyone inside. You turn on the telly and every other story is telling you somebody died. My sister killed a baby cause she couldn't afford to feed it, and it was sending people to the moon. In September my cousin tried reefer for the very first time. Now he's doing horse. It's June. Neighbors should shine at home. But if a night falls and a bomb falls, will anybody see the dawn? Time.
Prince, Sign of the Times, the title track from his ninth studio album released on the 30th of March 1987 by Paisley Park Records and Warner Brothers Records.
Did you hear a dog barking right at the end there? Like a little wow?
No. Well, if it was, it was on a fair light, because the whole track, apart from the guitar, was recorded from stock sounds from a fair light. He didn't do any sampling, he just used stock sounds from a Fairlight.
Really?
And if you don't know what a Fairlight is, it's basically an old way of, it was one of the first big samplers. Huge. Our friend Aaron Clegg's got one in his loft in Douglas, I think, at the moment. But he's got and like the first samplers, Trevor Horn, you know, used them on all the early recordings, you know. But that is the thing about that track. And we haven't played Prince before.
No, and we talked about it, didn't we, about what we would play, because I've just felt like he needed to be on the show.
He is.
Yeah.
Now, and it's amazing. I mean, that track, he's done so many fantastic things. And I know a lot of it is that, like, the whole Purple Rain album is fantastic. I know it's very 80s, and stuff. But he was a consummate performer. He could play, he could write, he could sing, he could dance. He had everything. And he was multi-instrumentalist. I mean, a lot of the stuff he played, everything, didn't he? Drums.
It was crazy. But the thing that got me was that when he released 1999, and I don't know the year, I bought it on 7-inch single. And it didn't chart. And I was thinking, what is going on with everybody in the UK? I was going down to my local nightclub, disco, and Julian Knight used to do Negative Earth with Roy Wesley, a local disco. I used to ask, they had it. And I used to say, go on, play it. And it was like, and I'd be in the middle of the dance floor, go, tune. And it didn't do anything. And then a year later, they re-released it. And then it took off. I was just so frustrated with everyone. It's like, about the timing, about why didn't everyone get it the first time around? And I know that he went on and did bigger albums, but to me, nothing ever really connected as the same as 1999. And I think that I've got songs like Purple Rain now that have become more beautiful to me because of life experience when we did One Night Stand and Cath Crowe sang...
The late, great Cath Crowe.
Cath Crowe, when she sang Purple Rain, and I remember that. And to me, that will always be a part of a memory with her and Prince. And so, just interesting, isn't it? With
the music. I remember that when she did it, she decided not to do it in the right key. So, and it's a nightmare to play that thing because you've got to do it. It's all open tuning, really. You've got to have it. You've got to play it correctly. So it really is tricky.
I remember. I saw the rehearsals. Get in there, sunshine. But I mean, Prince has had an incredible body of work. He sold like 100 million albums, and he's just so, as you say, he's just super hugely talented. And what a loss, what a waste of. And I'm so sorry that he was in so much pain, with the medication and stuff. But lots of people fall foul of this, and I'm just so. And he's writing about the sign of the times, about drug addiction, about people not being able to, with the bust of the 80s and the how all the sort of wealth had gone, and yeah, you can't afford to feed your baby, but we're sending rockets to the moon. It's just really obscure, isn't it?
His lyrical content was certainly on that. I mean, it's just brilliant, and it's a great song, it really is a great song.
And with Prince as well, he won 8 Grammy Awards, 6 American Music Awards, a Golden Globe and an Academy Award for the film Purple Rain.
Yeah, it's a great film.
Yeah.
I tell you what I love about that song, I love that middle eight where it actually just shifts up and his guitar, it's so funky and so groovy and so appropriate, Beautiful play.
And
beautiful.
Did you notice, what I noticed as well, there's space in that song.
That's all it is. It's just loads of space.
Yeah, yeah.
There's nothing else going on except a great groove and a great funk and a great lyric, a great, great vocal. But what happened to us this morning, we actually just watched and we saw, it was a live performance. I can't remember which tour it was. And it was him and Sheila E was playing drums.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the middle of it, and it was, they had about a million people on stage. There were horn players. There were
a whole village.
Ladies, with older ladies on piano and keyboards. It was very glamorous, but it was a spectacular event. And then in the minute they stopped for two bars, and Sheila E and Prince swapped between drums, didn't they? He went on the drums, Sheila E started singing, and it was almost seamless. Well, it was seamless.
It was.
And it was, the groove was fantastic. And he comes back, snapping on the floor with the snare, he comes, snap, and then he's singing, boop, da, do, do, do. Amazing. Just incredible. And I just love that,
Yeah, it's like he's got sherbet in his pants.
Ants.
million in prizes. Oh, we have a torture film, drive a GTO, wear a uniform, a line of government loan. I'm worth a million in prizes. Yeah, I'm through with sleeping on the sidewalk. No more beating my brains. No more beating my brains. With liquor and drugs. With liquor and drugs. Well, I'm just a modern guy. Of course, I had it in my ear before. Could have lost for long. Could have lost for long. Got lost for long. Got lost for long. Oh, I lost for long. Oh, I lost for long.
Iggy Pop and Lust for Life, the title track from his second solo studio album, released on the 29th of August in 1977 on RCA Records.
Yes, and David Bowie is playing keyboards on that.
He was indeed.
And they're in the studio together. And this was the Berlin period.
Yeah, it was recorded at Hansa Studio by the Wall.
Now, Hansa Studio, we've watched the documentary, haven't we?
Yeah.
It's amazing documentary.
It's fascinating, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, we were talking on the show last week about Einstürz and the Neubauten, destruction of new buildings and all those guys.
Say that again.
Einstürz and the Neubauten.
When you say that.
It's great, isn't it? Destruction of new buildings. That's what I think it means. But band, of course. But, you know, Hansa was an amazing, amazing studio. And it's so sad. Because I'm reading the book, Great British Recording Studios, at the moment. I've been reading it for a few weeks now. And on and off. And it's so sad that all these studios have actually disappeared. And I get it, the commercial reasons why people don't need them, there's no budgets anymore, but the music that was created in them and the atmosphere that they generated for creativity, you know, it's difficult to see that that's actually going to become, you know, come back again, because you just don't get that now.
It's become depersonalised. It's a bit like in the whole of the media, you know, with the BBC when they moved up to Media City at Salford. They brought in a hot desk culture, so you didn't have your own desk going in. When I used to work at Granada TV in Manchester, you'd have your own space every day, and it'd be your space. Well, when you hot desk, you go in, it's not yours. Anyone could be there at any point. You could be moved anywhere. So so impersonal, and you had to keep anything personal off and in your own locker somewhere. And I think that's the same kind of thing that's happening, because music's a communication tool, and I think it's just become very depersonalised and just that's it. I think that's what's happened.
I mean, an Iggy Pop in this, Carlos, the wonderful Carlos Alomar on guitar.
Yes.
He's played.
The sound of his name.
Yeah. Well, he's played on more Bowie stuff than anybody apart from Mike Garson, apparently, Carlos Alomar. Great guitar player. You can always tell it's him. You know, and the Sales Brothers, bass and drums, and because they played in Tin Machine with
Bowie
later on.
That's right, exactly. Mm. And do you know what the inspiration for Lust for Life came from? It
Go
was
on.
Inspired by the Morse code opening to the American Forces Network news in Berlin.
No.
Yeah. So, and that's really, I mean, and that's taking, like, influences of right around you in that place. Mm. And you can see, you know, what I love is the stories of when you move somewhere. We've had this when we've been in France and Spain, that you bring that influence into your music. It can't not affect you. It
well,
does, doesn't it?
And that's right. And we're looking to reopen our studio in Europe now.
Indeed.
Possibly in Germany, we don't know. But we are very fortunate in that we have our recording equipment. We can do it at home, you know,
absolutely.
but making sure that our home is our studio, because what we do is that we think about you know, how we create a space basically around our music, don't we?
Well, I know, but the thing is, we don't really need a house as house sake. We just need a room with a roof on, a high
Correct.
Roof, and somewhere to sleep, and somewhere to cook, and somewhere to wash.
Yeah.
But
big high ceilings for drums.
Well,
and
I know. Well, when we were in France, we slept in the studio. We had our flute on in the corner, didn't we? Because that was the best room in the whole house anyway. Who wouldn't want to wake up to sing loads of guitars in the morning?
Yeah.
I mean, and it was a beautiful French countryside. And that's the thing. It's about having adventures and actually going out. And you know, it's such a luxury as well. It's not easy. You have to make big sacrifices. And it takes a lot of courage and a lot of confidence to just go, well, that's a hopefulness actually as well.
Yeah, that's right.
And while our health is with us, I think it's really important we take advantage of meeting you on the road. That's basically what it's about.
Absolutely.
Recording beautiful music and going out on the road and playing live and coming to play the gig near you and saying hello in person, you know, and sharing a beer or two or a good glass of wine.
Fantastic.
I love that. I want, baby. Oh, crumbs, it's nearly the end of the show.
No.
We're going to run over.
Oh, no.
We are. Well, thanks so much for joining us for this week's episode of the Supertone Show. You can contact us on Facebook. We've got a website as well, supertonerecords.com.
Yeah.
Please say hello on there. And also, we're on Twitter at Susie and Simon, S-U-Z-Y.
Yeah, and Mixcloud and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, we're not going to talk much longer because...
Here comes the sun, and I say, it's all right.